This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at wyll.uruc.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to take a look at early American houses and what day-to-day life was like in the early years of the Republic. Our guest is Jack Larkin, the museum scholar and chief historian at Old Sturbridge Village in Sturbridge, Massachusetts. He is the author of Where We Live, Discovering the Places We Once Called Home, the American Home from 1775 to 1840. Of old houses, Mr. Larkin says, they seem full of something glimpsed but not completely knowable, the everyday life and tangled family emotions of the past. In the past, he says, houses were places not only in which to live, but also to be born, to fall ill, to be cared for, and to die. Where We Lived opens with an overview of early American houses. That's followed by chapters devoted to houses by region. The book also features hundreds of black and white photographs from the Library of Congress Historic Building Survey. The survey began during the Great Depression to provide work to out-of-work photographers and architects. Listeners, I look forward to your phone calls this afternoon. You can join our discussion. Your questions and comments for Jack Larkin are invited. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. In addition to his duties at Old Sturbridge Village, Jack Larkin is an affiliate professor of history at Clark University in Worcester. A native of Chicago, he's also the author of The Reshaping of Everyday Life, 1790 to 1840. Where We Lived is the first in a planned series from the Taunton Press and the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Listeners, I welcome your phone calls for Jack Larkin. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Jack Larkin, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, it's good to be here, Celeste.
You liken old houses to emissaries from another time, and you say they should be studied, explored, and admired. What are some of the things these emissaries can tell us about who we were, where we've come from?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different ways of looking at them. One of the nicest ways is to get an old house that that still survives with some documentation that helps us understand who lived there, what the patterns of their life might have been, even maybe sometimes some of their own reflections about what it was like to live in a house. It wouldn't have been an old house then necessarily. Of course, that's one of the interesting things we have to keep thinking of. That of course the people of the past didn't delight to live in quaint houses. As far as they were concerned, they were as up to date as you could be. They were fully engaged in the present. It's us, of course, who see them as quaint, but they're perhaps not quaint to most of us now, hopefully, but they're certainly different. And, one of the things that struck me, as struck other historians, too, looking at the record of the past houses, was how small most early American houses were, how large families were, how small houses were, how crowded family life was in the past, and how houses were literally full of life because there were so many people living in so many of them.
Yeah, it seems like people were just spilling out of these houses.
Well, in some cases, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, there is a house that you write about and the family that lived there. And this family was, I lost the name now. But anyway, the visitor an Englishman, provides us a wonderful glimpse into what life was like in this home. Edward Perry, he was an Englishman in America in 1775, and he was a guest of the Parkers.
Yes, he was sort of an involuntary guest because he was an English agent for the Royal Navy. He was looked at with some suspicion because the American Revolution was just beginning. So he was sort of interned for a year out in a little town of Sturbridge, actually where Old Sturbridge Village is, out in the middle of Massachusetts. And so his account of his nearly a year he spent in the small, very small town of Sturbridge is not flattering to his hosts at all. He found that house, the house he was living in, extremely small, extremely smelly, difficult to live in because, as far as he was concerned, its inhabitants had very minimal conceptions of privacy. Of course, he was the 13th person in a small house. They were farmers and engaged in all the very unvarnished occupations of farming, and he was an English gentleman who was used to having his keeping everything like that at a much more comfortable distance. So, he tells us what it was like in there in a way that very few other people do. Even if it wasn't a loving description, but it was a pretty precise one, I think.
Yeah, I bet it's quite accurate. I mean, after all, you've got a house of 700 square feet with 12 people living in it, and then he's there as a guest, and then there were other people who would come to visit and stay, and he was often asked to share his bed.
Yes, now that's really an interesting thing, because it was very common for people to share beds in early America, among all but the wealthiest. But, of course, Perry didn't think much of that at all. He did not enjoy it. He says, "Oh, especially a journeyman shoemaker who was traveling around making shoes for the people in the neighborhood state." You know, and so the thought that he an aristocrat would share a bed with a common shoemaker was almost too much for him. So, of course, the American Revolution was being fought out in part, of course, on issues of were shoemakers as good as aristocrats or not?
Right.
So he definitely had took one position, and that the revolutionaries wouldn't have agreed with at all. But he kept his diary secret, which is fortunate for him, because he would have been in a lot of trouble had Captain Parker, who was his host, had Captain Parker had a chance to read it.
Yeah. Also, there's another person that you include in the book, a woman by the name of Margaret Hall, and it was a good thing her thoughts were also kept private, her letters.
Yes, she was again an aristocratic English woman who accomplished sort of an amazing feat. She, her husband, and her toddler daughter and nursemaid traveled the length and breadth of the United States for between 1828 and 1829, which was kind of an astonishing feat. If you think about what it is like today traveling with a small child, just imagine doing it in the 1820s when you were traveling by stagecoach and steamboat. That was remarkable. But her letters home to her sister, which eventually were published in the 1930s, were just a scathing indictment of virtually everything about American life. She just thought it was she just did not enjoy it. But her descriptions again are very precise, and so they're very useful to us if we're trying to understand what life was like. We can maybe filter out a little bit of the hostility, but the descriptions are really useful.
Well, we fell far short of passing the white glove test in Margaret Hall's.
Yes, indeed. I think that's probably fairly accurate. that was mostly the case. But she did look very specifically at things. In fact, women are much better observers of the domestic scene, as you might, and probably not too surprising, than men, because that was part of their portfolio, to be responsible for. Sometimes men were good observers, but women almost always were, when we can find their descriptions. And I found them probably the most useful in some ways.
Yeah. Were there observers? Were there people passing through and traveling in the United States or in the what was about to become the United States who found it bracing, who celebrated small R republicanism?
Oh, quite a few did. Yeah, quite a few found many good things to say about the United States. But, you know, ethnocentricity is so powerful, and the tendency to judge another place by the standards of your own is indeed very prevalent that almost all the foreign travelers found something to criticize about American life, particularly its relatively crude and provincial nature, they thought, compared, say, to life in London or Paris. On the other hand, many of them were very sympathetic to American political institutions, to the beginning of the expansion of democracy and the franchise, to Republican government, to representative institutions. And an awful lot of people came to the United States to see how this experiment was actually working out. And so many of them talked a good deal about politics and what they liked and didn't like about that. Some were hostile, some were very favorable. What I was interested in, of course, was sort of the other side of it. I wanted to see what they saw very directly about the concrete life of Americans. Some were very favorably impressed by Americans, particularly American upper class houses. Except for those who were determined not to be impressed at all, like Mrs. Hall. But most of them were impressed by that. But then there were other things like the question of slavery, which distressed many travelers to America, of course.
Yeah. There are photographs of Drayton Hall in the book.
Yes, yes.
A plantation house in South Carolina. Would you describe Drayton Hall for our listeners?
Well, Drayton Hall is this extraordinary mid-18th century house. It sits on this extraordinary site on the Cumbahee River. It has the most remarkable great rooms, a great hall on the first floor, a great drawing room on the second floor. It's wonderful sweeping staircases. Up in the basement, the lower story of Drayton Hall, are spaces for the servitors, the household slaves, where cooking went on, where meals were prepared, with back stairways for the slaves to walk up, so the slaves or household servants would never have to interact with honored guests coming into the house through the front. So it's really quite an extraordinary place, and of course it has many rooms. It was perhaps, if you valued the cost of the house or the worth of the house, it would probably cost more than the total worth of some small villages up in the north. Actually, you know, so it's quite an extraordinary place, and we have some photographs of it, the amazing details and the plaster ceiling and the woodwork. And I'm glad to say that Drayton Hall is still thriving as an historical exhibit. It's still there and can be visited, and gives us a taste of the life of the great planters of the South, a life that in many ways was quite extraordinary, even if it was undergirded, of course, by slavery.
Right. I have visited Drayton Hall, and correct me if I'm wrong, but is it owned by the National Trust for Historic Preservation?
Yeah. It's one of the... And the support of the National Trust has been, you know, really, really great for this book. And one of the things we're trying to do, obviously, is to give as many readers as possible a taste of the houses of the past. Perhaps taking a slightly different look at them. The book isn't all about great and stately houses. It's about the whole housing landscape from top to bottom. And also, you know, interweaving it with stories, just to give people a sense of why it's particularly interesting and hopefully particularly a good idea to preserve as much of the past as we practically can as we sail on into the 21st century.
Yeah. Now, the Drayton family, how large was it, and would things have been, you know, even though it's a big, grand house, would it have still been crowded?
Well, at various times it could have been crowded. It probably might, the family size is going to vary, a great deal over the generations, depending on the age of the primary family and the precise number of children. It probably was big enough a house that probably at times was crowded. I imagine certainly you can imagine if there's a wedding or some uh, some ceremony that brings relatives in from all over the place, then even a house like that is going to be crowded for a while it's full of guests and guests and visitors. Of course, in a house like that, it might even, you know, a house like that, even among the aristocracy, there might still have been sometimes slaves, men servants or maid servants, even shared bedrooms with their masters and mistresses, so mm-hmm. they could be there to perform any office they were asked to. So even a house like that could be crowded.
Yeah.
Although certainly it's a lot less crowded than, say, the slave cabins out that were
yeah.
out behind the house. They must have had 60 or 70 cabins, I'm sure, at the height of the plantation.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I'm recalling from my visit is that what I want to talk with you about here is our concept of personal space is so much different today than it was, you know,
yep.
back then. One of the things I remember about Drayton Hall is that the family privy, you know, had a number of seats right in a row. So there was a lot of togetherness.
Yes, absolutely right. I mean, every privy you look at, actually, well, there are some, of course, what you call one-holers in the small, you know, smaller houses. But you'll see quite a few that are, you know, suggest a great deal of togetherness. Even when you go inside, you look inside the privy and you see that there's a lot of finished woodwork and everything like that. So,
yeah. Quite a wide range of housing in our early years.
We go off to, you know, a house of 400 square feet,
yeah,
which might have a whole family in it to several thousand square feet. And of course, today we're following kind of two trajectories. One is an increasing, you know, the increasing size of houses, increasing, and the decreasing size of families. So that the average American family today has a square footage that only the wealthy could command back in the time that I'm writing about.
Yeah, you compare some housing censuses and population censuses in the book, and if I can turn to this page here, by combining the 1798 house census with the 1800 population census for two small farming communities, the township of Lower Alloways Creek in New Jersey and the town of Brookfield, Massachusetts, the results are eye-opening. Brookfield houses average just over 120 square feet per person. Lower Alloways houses had about 90 square feet per person. In contrast, the Federal Houses Survey for 99-2000 reported an average of 12,000 square feet per person.
I think that would be right. Unless there's a typo in the book.
Yeah. So today,
about 10 times.
Yeah, 10 to 14 times more space than our ancestors had.
Right, right. Yeah, we have more space than we often know what to do with in most houses, actually.
Yeah.
I think now that gives us a lot more privacy. And we think we tend to think privacy on the whole is a good thing. Gives us more space to heat, of course.
Yeah.
And it it means, of course, that our the kinds of the ways that we interact as families tend to be pretty different in a culture where houses are very small and everyone sits around the fire or a little later on perhaps the stove and in the winter in those cultures, then obviously there's a kind of physical constraints that dictate certain kinds of family interaction. It's just going to happen. It's going to happen whether you like it or not, almost.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jack Larkin. He's the author of Where We Live, Discovering the Places We Once Called Home, the American Home, from 1775 to 1840. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the telephone numbers. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number to call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Why does 1840 mark the end of this period of American homes?
Well, any fixed date is always a little bit arbitrary. We needed to cut it off somewhere. It tends to be roughly the limits of my detailed expertise in history. Historians sort of divide up patterns, periods of time in sort of patterned ways. But the other thing really is that in the late 1830s or late 1840s, many things about American building began to change. That's with the development of balloon frame construction. Use of what we basically call 2x4s to put up houses instead of the heavy timber frames that mm-hmm. are characteristic of earlier houses. So that marked a significant change. Also, of course, the United States begins to transform in many ways with the railroad, the continued growth of industry and urbanization, and America's tending toward becoming a different world. And so my sense was that 1775 to 1840, the young United States could be one book, and then there could be another book about Victorian America and housing in Victorian America. But that's probably for somebody else to write.
Okay.
Who knows that period? Who knows that period really extremely well? But that would be a history of different sorts of things, because you'd be looking at the evolution of household appliances and heating and the changes in household technology, as well as in construction techniques and the growth of great cities and so forth. So that's another American
mm-hmm.
world.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things for me about the book was that in the writing, we were sort of combining three different historical worlds. One was the world of the early American Republic. One was the world of the 1930s, which is the time in which the great majority of these photographs were taken during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was the modern world of the Internet, because the fact that the American Library of Congress made all these images available online made the research really for this book possible. So there's sort of three intersecting periods of time that together made together were a way of looking at were my way of looking at the book, at the task.
We've got a couple of listeners who would like to talk with you. Let's go first to a caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. I missed the typo. It was 12,000 square feet?
1,200.
Okay, the real value is 1,200.
That's right.
And what was the year?
I'm sorry.
That's okay. The year was, that year, 1,200, so that's 1999, 2000,
right.
At least based on the census
okay.
data.
That's I feel very like I got a lot of room now. Thank
yeah.
you a lot.
Yeah, you're doing well.
Yeah, compared to way back. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. That was I misread that.
Good, because
yeah.
I was afraid. Oh my
no,
gosh.
No, I misread that, and
pages.
I was not sharp enough here this afternoon to pick up on the fact that I had misread that. So
okay.
My apologies. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
I would like to ask a question about the Cape Cod house.
Okay.
Yes.
That was probably pretty prevalent in the time you were talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. They're very, very common in New yeah. England, and not just on Cape Cod.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's a story, a single story, usually right. a story and a half, a story in an attic
right.
or a story with dormers, a house with a central chimney.
Right, exactly, yeah. Well, those houses... the roof of those houses have very little overhang, and I was wondering, they have no gutters. I've never understood quite why that was.
Why no gutters?
No gutters and no overhang, so the rain runs off the roof, right to where the foundation is, and the foundation of very old houses is just fieldstone.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Very.
So how
very
does
often.
That work? Do you know?
Well, that's a good question. I do know some. Cape Cod style houses, or small store and have central chimney houses that
yeah.
that do have more overhang. I agree. Probably a lot of them built on the Cape specifically don't seem to have seem to have that, and that is a little mysterious. I'm afraid I really couldn't. We just have to hypothesize. I certainly haven't seen any documents that would tell us exactly why that's the case. I mean, the form itself is actually pretty common through much of New England, and it's got some. Variations, but probably I think you're think many houses on the Cape do seem to have that sort of gutterless and very, very minimal overhang.
Yeah.
It's a good question. Exactly why they built them that way. It's sometimes you wind up with mysteries. You're just not sure.
Right. Another thing was the chimney, the central chimney, which is huge.
Right. Very big central chimney. Yeah.
Several fireplaces feeding into it, and then I noticed that in the old houses, there's no flashing around the chimney. Now, was that because there was always a fire going, or maybe
just about always? Yes. Yeah.
It's
relatively rare, at least in New England, for the fire ever to be let completely go out. You know, you'd usually have embers.
Well,
embers in at least one of the fireplaces.
They cooked in the kitchen, so that was always going, I suppose.
Right, just about. And you usually try to stir up the embers in the morning and get the fire going. But those chimneys really, and especially the earliest New England houses are just some they're really quite enormous.
Yeah, they are. So, but I couldn't figure out why there was no flashing used around them.
Well, a fair number of these things are later technical improvements as people begin to think more and more about such issues. For example, fireplace design really changes even for the New England houses like this in the late 18th and early 19th century. The shape of the fireplace changes. The fireplaces become smaller and shallower and designed on the designed more on the sort of early thermodynamic principles, and so they do become more efficient. And the other thing is, for example, you'll find very little insulation in early houses, even when people are complaining bitterly about how cold they are. At least in New England, you open up a house, and you're not going to see very much packed in between the rafters, the joists to keep them warm. And so although people were trying to seal up doors and windows, at least to some extent. So, it's just interesting. There's a different consciousness develops of what's technically possible. And even in the 19th century, I think that's when you see more of these refinements.
I have one more question from the roof to the floor. Is it the case that the old houses had no subflooring and just the big boards straight on the beams?
Often that's the case. Sometimes you'll see subflooring, but often that's true. Sometimes you'll actually see in a tavern or someplace where it has a ballroom, you'll see a fairly elaborate subflooring system to give literally give the floor spring.
Yeah,
there's a subfloor on the top. The top boards are actually relatively loosely placed, so the floor will spring a bit, and that's of course a little more elaborate than most procedures. Most procedures were.
Yeah. Okay. Also, they needed the bearing strength, I suppose. If there's
right,
a lot of people.
Right. They'd have a lot of there'd be a lot of bearing strength from the timber.
Right. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You're
nice
welcome.
To talk to you.
Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Jack Larkin. He is the author of Where We Live, Discovering the Places We Once Called Home, the American Home, from 1775 to 1840. Our guest is also the museum scholar and chief historian at Old Sturbridge Village in Sturbridge, Massachusetts. He's also the author of The Reshaping of Everyday Life, 1790 to 1840. That last caller talked about the Cape Cod. The American houses of this period, how American are they? How are they departures from the houses of Europe?
Well, the travelers coming over saw the American landscape as in many cases really looking quite different. Sometimes they would see city houses in Boston that reminded them of English provincial cities, for example, or even of London to some extent. But when they looked at the wooden housing landscape of America, most of which was wood, they saw something that was quite different from what they were mostly used to in Europe. And then saw these typical forms, the New England collaborative central chimney house, whether it was a single-story Cape Cod or a larger style sort of old-fashioned New England Central Chimney Farmhouse was pretty, well, you know, was seen as a pretty distinctive New England feature. They'd also, of course, find echoes of Europe, you know, in the American, Georgian, and Federal style were, mm-hmm. of course, linked to English styles and probably derivative from them. So they'd see some things that struck them as familiar and some things that weren't. If you came from rural Germany, the Rhineland or the Palatinate districts of rural Germany, and went to Pennsylvania, you might see some stone houses and stone barns that reminded you that remind you of that place. In the Hudson Valley, you'd see some architecture, and especially some old Dutch towns like Albany or Schenectady, that would remind you of Amsterdam or The Hague. You know, the particular architectural shapes and forms that were brought over in the 17th or the early in the 18th century, and then modified. But there's always this question of these styles being modified to fit American conditions, particularly right. The American preference for every place except really the middle states of building in wood for the most part.
It's interesting to see how people coped with building materials, you know, what was at hand, and also where they were located, what conditions were like. For example, in the South, you might see houses taking advantage of summer breezes with upstairs porches and windows and doors placed so the movement of air could come through because, you know, we don't have air conditioning at this point.
Oh, no, not at all. And then you'd see things like the dog trap house, houses built with a very wide central, very wide open space, really roofed over, but otherwise very open between what essentially are two freestanding, walled in rooms. And the dog trot name came later with the notion that dogs would run back and forth. Right through the house. That's sort of a lower south kind of design in 1820s and 30s that becomes pretty prevalent for quite a while. Mm. You see in the farther south you go, the more likely are you to see separate kitchen buildings.
So you would avoid
part of the main house at all.
So you'd avoid the heat.
Yeah, the main house would just have a small chimney for the cooler months of the year, but most of the heavy heating and cooking would be done in a separate space. And of course, in slaveholding households, very often the household slaves might well just live in the kitchen building as well, for at least most of them. So you'd see patterns. See patterns like that, and of course, in New England, the coldest part of the United States, there's a reliance in much of the architecture on the large central chimney placed in the very middle of the house to conserve heat and to radiate it to as many rooms as possible.
Let's take another call. A listener in Downers Grove, line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to ask your guest if he could comment about how ceiling heights have changed throughout the years. I know many of the older buildings in Chicago, around the turn of the century, we had 12-foot ceilings. And now, at what point did they come down to, like, 8 feet?
Yeah, that's interesting. Ceiling height has gone up and down in the course of American history. Relatively early houses often are quite small and have low ceilings. If you look at many houses in the 17th and early 18th century, it used to be thought it was really entirely because people were shorter then, and their heads, they just wanted small houses because they weren't tall. That's really not the case. It seems to have something to do both with the custom of the time and also with some attempt, and at least part of most people, to conserve on building materials. But over time, rooms do get larger. So by the early 19th century, There are larger ceiling heights, and that seems to continue into the Victorian period. So you got this part of it's an accent on verticality in houses. Why do they get you know, why do we move from the sometimes those very large, the very tall ceilings to shorter ones? Well, that's, again, that's partly a stylistic change. I don't know how many people really were thinking of economizing on heat. Certainly, the turn of the century. Partly, just architects start to think differently about how they want to design spaces. I know I live in an old Victorian house, and certainly it's got high ceilings. You know, I have friends who live in a more modern ranch house that has lower ceilings, and of course it doesn't relate to the, as I say, to the average height of Americans. There are some issues of fashion that just seem to move up and down, and it's not always easy to tell exactly why. You know, there are other trends like the size of windows, which has been continually going up since about 1650. We have more and more glass, more and more large windows in our houses, and that's been sort of a steady change over time. And also it's nice, like things like standards for lighting levels, they've been going up and up and up and up.
I appreciate your answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this
Thank
afternoon.
You.
One other thing that has changed quite a bit is how one would be welcomed into a home, what the entries were like. And I live in a very old house, and it is when you come into the house, you are in the house.
Oh, that's great. That's called a socially open house by anthropologists. Yeah, that's you're in the house, you're in. And
you're
so
in.
Whatever the family's doing, you
that's
know,
right.
pitch right in. We're glad to see you.
You're in the sitting room.
That's not often, that wasn't always the case. And, in the time period we're talking about, in America, there are both socially open and then this notion of a socially closed or limited house where there's an entryway or even in other houses, a very large entry hall in which the visitor, you know, sort of a threshold space. The visitor passes over the threshold, but he or she isn't yet let into the bosom of the family. The doors might be closed, and someone will come out and find out who you are and what room you need to come into, or whether they want to just talk to you out in the hall. And it's related, of course, to an increasing concern for privacy and control over who visits your house. And so we can see both kinds of houses are abundantly available in the life of America at the time of the early republic. Of course, a one-room house, you didn't have much choice. You know, you were going to be in anyway. But it really is quite interesting, and it tends to have something to do with social class. Obviously, the more well-to-do folks are, the more likely they are to have this kind of buffer between them and the outside. In New England, which of course is renowned for is certainly today a relatively a place of where people are more concerned about their privacy and sometimes thought to be less friendly, than, at least superficially, than those in other regions. So New England there probably were more socially closed houses in New England by, say, the middle of the 19th century than there were in other regions.
Mm.
Even a lot of relatively small houses have these small entryways where you're not in the room, not in the kitchen or the parlor yet. You're mm-hmm. just in kind of a threshold space, and then we see some houses that actually changed from a socially open to a socially closed house as people perhaps feeling dictates of fashion or wanting to change and become more genteel, more private in the way they carried on their social life. And so, you know, these are interesting things we can read in houses. Out in the West, and of course, in the time I'm talking about, Illinois is very much part of the West. Most
right.
people live in relatively small, socially open houses. Often they're cabins or small houses that are still pretty provisional on the landscape. You know, they're looking forward to something bigger and better, as Americans often tend to do.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Kankakee, line 4. Hi.
What features of houses of the past that have gone by the wayside come to mind, which we might particularly do well to reincorporate into new housing construction? Thank you.
That's
a good question.
Gosh, that's an interesting question. I'm trying to think what it really would be. We, you know, some of those things have gone up and going up and down. I don't know whether we'd really want to go toward making houses smaller so that people would be forced to come together and to socialize. Families would be forced to come together and to socialize in some way. And maybe that wouldn't be a bad idea. Our houses are so sort of socio-fugal these days. I mean, at least the newest, some of the newest ones, what they call these McMansions, these large houses, sometimes with many thousands of square feet for only two people. Certainly. I mean, one of the things that that anyone who likes old houses would love to see, but of course it tends to be very expensive. Some of the is the wonderful woodwork and detailing of rooms. You don't even have to go to the extent obviously people did in Drayton Hall, but the paneling and detailing that you can see even pretty ordinary farmhouses, say in the late 18th and early 19th century still, is something that. Many of us would like to have in our own houses today. It's just that the capitalized cost of that, of all that handwork, to reintroduce handwork is a complicated thing. I think many people, however, are already doing another thing, which is to make the kitchen a greater focus of life. I think some people at least do that pretty informally. That's something that it often was in early housing.
And I think it's interesting that the living room, or what used to be called, the parlor, is has fallen from favor in newer homes.
Yeah, newer homes. It certainly has. I mean, most of us probably would remember our mother's living rooms, our mother's parlors. Sometimes with the couch you didn't sit on except when your grandmother came, and so forth, the visit, and so forth. But that's people are taking a somewhat more informal approach, and perhaps even they're moving to more socially open houses. And I think that would be something interesting to think about. Would that be a good thing? Maybe it would. Maybe that's an early American approach that would be useful to think about. I don't know that I'd advocate going back to the privy or to sleeping two or three to a bed.
No, thank you.
As much togetherness as that provided for people, it's probably not the direction in which we'd want to go. I mean, I personally love the patterns of interior decoration, often whether they're really very vernacular or quite formal, that people were able to enjoy, even pretty ordinary folks were able to enjoy in their houses, and it'd be nice to see more of that. But if it's real, it involves handwork, and that in our culture, our economy is expensive. On the other hand, of course, we have domestic technology beyond anyone's dreams.
Yeah.
In the time I'm talking about, and that's perhaps sort of the trade-off, the social openness, the handwork that we find very attractive, and the domestic technology of plumbing and heating and lighting and sanitation that they would have found enormously attractive had it ever occurred to them that it was possible.
Yeah, one of the things I really love about where we lived is, of course, the photographs. And they were made during the Great Depression. They are in the Library of Congress Historic Building Survey. The photographs of these houses that were made beginning back in the Great Depression, how many of these homes survive?
That's a good question. I've been asked that a number of times, and I can't give a really good answer, because we'd really have to go out and do field work, of the same kind of field work that they did in the 30s. Maybe a couple of my friends at the Historic American Building Survey, if I asked them a question, might have a sense. I think many of these houses obviously have not survived. We know that some of them have, and we had a little feature in the book called Still Standing about some of them. Whether we can say 10 or 20%, 30%, it'd be nice to have a figure like that. We certainly know that many of them, certainly if we look at some of them that are looking fairly decrepit or pretty vulnerable already. So that, from the 30s to the aughts, there's certainly been a lot of there's certainly been a lot of loss. It's I wish I knew a good figure for it. I know it's probably pretty high, just because that's the way of the world. That's the way that and that's the way that America changes. We certainly know that some of the larger, more impressive buildings we show in the book are still there. Monticello is still standing, and so forth. But you know, some of those monuments to the life of ordinary people, these one and two and three room houses. I know that quite a few are still around, all things considered. But I know that there's been a lot of loss. Someone would actually have to go and literally, as I said, do a field work, almost do a census to tell us what that proportion would be. And maybe the preservationist in me just doesn't even want to hear it.
Yeah.
I don't even want to know how much of that is lost. But, you know, we'd literally probably have to go follow some of those roads.
Yeah. Well, it would also be interesting to just put a call out to the American public. Do you live in an old house? Register here on this website or something like that, or drop us a postcard. That would be fabulous.
Yeah, that would really be neat.
Yeah. There, we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Jack Larkin, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure talking to you this afternoon.
Historian Jack Larkin has been our guest in this portion of the program. He's the author of Where We Live, Discovering the Places We Once Called Home, The American Home from 1775 to 1840. The book is the first in a planned series from the Taunton Press and the National Trust for Historic Preservation.